This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow.
On the good ship, Lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay.
You know who that is, which says something because she was at the peak of her fame in the late 1930s. It's Shirley Temple, the iconic child actress with her hair and ringlets, a baby doll face, and a toothy smile. She was once the biggest film star in the world. But her influence transcends Hollywood and pop culture. Her carefully constructed persona was also influential in shaping the political and cultural dynamics of the 1930s. The life and legacy of Shirley Temple is the subject of a new book by cultural historian Jonathan Kasson. It's called The Little Girl Who Fought the Great Depression. Jonathan Kasson's a professor of history and American studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and he joins us in the studio today. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's John.
Well, nice to talk with you, John and Jonathan. Now I've got you both here, so I only have half the time for each of you. John, tell me how you got interested in Shirley Temple.
I got interested in Shirley Temple by thinking about the rise of celebrity culture and the rise of the smile and the ways in which the Great Depression was not only an economic crisis, the greatest economic crisis in American history, but also a great emotional crisis. And I was interested in how politicians, famously FDR, but also how Hollywood addressed that. And it's, of course, something that everyone knows, that Hollywood created a lot of feel-good movies in the 1930s. And I didn't want to turn over that impression, but really ask, how did that work? And Shirley Temple, I think, is the figure more than anyone else who can show us how greatly and how intimately Hollywood affected the lives of everyday people in the United States, and for that matter, throughout much of the world in the 1930s, that she became the most loved, most adored, most influential movie star, I would say, really in history.
Tell us about that rise to fame.
She was born in 1928. Later, publicist said it was 1929 to make her look even more remarkably young and prodigious. And her mother, from literally the time she was in the womb, envisioned a career for her in some way as a stage or movie figure. And her mother got her into a dance studio that was a kind of channel for stage and screen child actors when she was three. And she played in various movie shorts from the time she was three and a half. And then it was the month she turned six that in April 1934, that Stand Up and Cheer was released. And although she had only seventh billing in that movie became, she became an overnight sensation in that film. And from that became, within that year, one of the greatest stars in American and world history. And she was the box office champion in the world for four consecutive years, from 1935 through 38, a record never equaled.
Yeah, nobody's ever done it since, according to your book. And the interesting thing is she might not have ever gotten that role or been the star that she became had she been more successful or had the production company she worked for in shorts and educational films kept going.
That's right. She was working with this company called Educational Films, in some ways a misnomer, that was in this area called Poverty Row of the minor Hollywood studios, and her mother was really looking for a place to get her into a major studio, and happened upon Jack Gorney, who had written with Yip Harburg the great Depression song "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" And he was working on a movie with Lou Brown, and wasn't happy with a child actress in that film, and they tried out Shirley Temple, and she did a dance that she learned at the dance studio, and she was thrust into the film with Jimmy Dunn, and as they say, the rest was history.
The rest was history. So the big moment for her was a very small role, as you say, seventh billing, in a movie called Stand Up and Cheer, but when she led the parade, that's apparently what America was looking for in the 30s.
That's right, and it's a movie that very much associated Hollywood with the New Deal, with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and the end of the film celebrates the end of the Depression, that everyone feels good again, and Shirley Temple and the other children and other entertainers have got people to break the concern with fear and bring good times, good spirits, and those would go together. That's the premise of the film, and it's It was also Hollywood needed Shirley Temple, and Fox needed Shirley Temple. Hollywood had suffered a lot from the Depression, and they were moral critics hitting them from all sides for some of the films they were using to try to get people back into the theater. So Shirley came along at just the right time for them as this child actress with a heart of gold and a smile that had the Midas touch.
Well, you talked about that smile, and of course FDR famous for that smile too, and that confident voice on radio that he had branded and been successful with. Shirley Temple's smile, an icon now, but she is a young girl, and that added a dimension, a dynamic in this cauldron of despair that was the United States, that was aspirational, right? She was the child.
That's right. Roosevelt, of course, had a smile that came from a person of great authority and great confidence. And his smile also was something that people took as part of his overcoming of his own great adversity and polio, and his own personal recovery was seen as in some ways analogous to what people would see as a national recovery. And with Shirley Temple, it was the smile of this adorable child that people literally wanted to have as a model for their own child. Her name became overnight the second most popular girl's name in the country and remained in the top five through the rest of the 1930s. She was, and in the early 30s, part of the Depression, one of the effects of the Depression was people had fewer children, and she becomes either the postponed child people wish they had or the child when they do have a child, the daughter they want to have. She becomes their image of the future in a very real as well as ideal way.
And the book is called The Little Girl Who Fought the Depression, Shirley Temple and the 1930s and 1930s America. John Kasson is the author. And John, you also point out that not only was she big in the United States, but worldwide there was the Shirley Temple phenomenon.
That's true. And of course, 20th Century Fox had representatives around the world. And what they did in the United States, they did in other countries. And the Hollywood empire was enormous at this time. Something like 70% of the world's screens were showing Hollywood product in the 1930s. And Shirley Temple, there were Shirley Temple lookalike contests in not only in Europe, but also in Sydney, Australia, in Cuba, in elsewhere in Latin America, in Bombay, India, in Japan, everywhere. She became the child that other children around the world across racial lines, religious lines, geographical lines wished to be.
And you also noticed her impact in the many fan letters that you went through, right?
Yes, and I wish that more were saved, but what I saw was only the tip of the iceberg, or the tip of the iceberg. But the fan letters came not only from children and from mothers, but they also came from men. I found this extraordinary letter from this man who had just gotten out of the penitentiary. He was what he described as a two-time loser, and he saw the film Baby Take a Bow, which was released later in 1934, where she surely is the child of an ex-convict. And he said, "Watching this film all the time, I knew it was hokum, but kid, you got to me, and I'm going to go straight from now on, and you're going to be my reason to go straight." She becomes his emotional center, his center of purity and goodness that he wants to do to go straight in order to live up to the ideal that she represents. I mean, that power she had for people for all kinds of ways, the way in which they brought their own personal issues to her and hung them on her image. It was extraordinary.
She had it. It was certainly something in a six-year-old girl, you'd have to say she had that in her. On the other hand, there was a carefully devised formula for those films that would have led many people to that conclusion. The flinty, irascible, adults that she had to deal with who would ultimately melt in her presence, that smile and determination. Talk about the formula and the way they created movies for her.
Sure. And they created scripts for her, movies for her, where she would be in one way or another in peril. Often she was missing one parent had died, sometimes both had died. And in various ways, in a sense, within the films, the question is who will care for her? And we might say, in that sense, viewers in the audience also answer that question, who is going to care for her? And so within the films, there are various people who, one way or another, adopt Shirley as their child. And, of course, people going to the theater adopt her, too, in another sense, take her into their hearts. She becomes their child. And Shirley stands in all these films for the child who is indomitable pluck and cheer and hope and confidence in the future. And she sings songs like, you've got to S-M-I-L-E to be H-A-P-P-Y and be optimistic, laugh, you son of a gun, come and get your happiness. She is the child who epitomizes hope in the future, cheer, joy, a sense that life is really going to work out and the rainbow is just around the next bend.
You explore the relationship with Bill Robinson, Bill Bojangles Robinson, in your book. Talk about their partnership and race relations in the 1930s.
Sure. FDR, of course, when he came into office, he would ultimately become the figure that African-Americans would support in very considerable numbers, but that was not true in the early 30s. And so much. But Bill Robinson was an earlier supporter of Roosevelt's. And Robinson had grown up very much, right, born in Richmond, Virginia, had grown up in the very much the Jim Crow South in the vaudeville circuit, which itself had its racial restrictions. He was the first African-American entertainer to be a single on the white vaudeville circuit. And then he joined with Shirley Temple in four films beginning in 1935. And he had his own smile, and he was known as the Dark Cloud of Joy, and his sense of smile and happy-go-lucky spirits was part of his own considerable charm. So when those two combined, we might say we had two of the greatest entertainer smiles and personalities in the country. At the same time, within those films, the racial etiquette of Jim Crow is still preserved. They can join hands, but only because he's a servant and she's this precious white girl who is his charge in films like The Little Colonel of 1935. It's in that film where they do the famous staircase dance. And Bill Robinson had developed a dance on stage, the staircase dance. He adapted that for the film. And then the question was, could they do something for Shirley there too? So he devised a little routine that she could do there. And people can look it up on YouTube. It's pretty magical. But those films were very popular among African Americans, but also very popular among whites, not just in the North, but in the South. So the films themselves didn't, in a sense, overturn anyone's preconceptions about race. What they did do, of course, is give Bill Robinson, this extraordinarily virtuosic tap dancer, scope to show everyone in the country who could afford to go to those films what he could do, and he was magnetically charming in those films and made Shirley even more charming.
Well, they also gave everybody a kind of a false sense that everything was okay, that race relations were now, since we're all in this together, we're all coming out of it together. In fact, you were recently on a BBC interview where, I guess the BBC interviewer got the sense that you were suggesting that somehow this either patched up race relations or showed that race relations were better than, in fact, they were.
That's right. And no, in one sense, people could walk out of the theaters believing exactly what they believed about race relations going into them. And it's always hard to say how a film changes something like that. But certainly the films gave African-Americans who had precious little among their own people to watch out on the screen, and almost always in servant roles. At least they could watch Bill Robinson, even when he was in a servant role, do some magnificent things. But Robinson was criticized within the African-American press even in the 30s and 40s by some because he was still stuck in Uncle Tom roles, as they would say, and various black intellectuals and critics, as well as everyday people, would be torn, on the one hand proud of Bill for what he could do, but on the one hand frustrated that he had to dance within this very circumscribed role.
Tell us about Shirley Temple's decline in popularity.
Shirley was immensely popular from 35 through 38. By 1939, she's in fact 11, and she's getting up toward puberty. Her popularity is beginning to decline. Her films, they've tried to vary the formula, but keep people expecting to see more of what they've come to know as a Shirley Temple film each time they come. it was a limit. She made about 20 films by the late 30s, 22 ultimately. And there's a question of what else can they give them? And she sinks to popularity in 35. And Daryl Zanuck and 20th Century Fox put all their, they make one big money winner. And The Little Princess in 39, and then in 1940 tried the Bluebird, which is a financial failure. In many ways, they're competing with The Wizard of Oz. After that, Shirley Temple's family, her parents, sever their contract with 20th Century Fox, and she makes fewer films in the 1940s, some successful, but ultimately, again, her big box office decline, and she withdraws. She makes her last film in 1949.
Yeah, but she didn't live in the past. She went on to have a public service career, served as ambassador to Ghana and Czechoslovakia, and remained sort of in somehow the public spotlight.
She did. She did a number of things. She had one child by her first marriage, which was brief and, by her own description, disastrous, and then two more children with a long and successful marriage with Charles Black. And she did a number of things, including diplomatic work. And she was a serious-minded adult. She was proud of what she did as a child, and she wrote a good autobiography called Child Star, published in 1988. But she did not dwell on the past. She did not, like Mary Pickford, sort of retreat into a pick fair and, you know, just go through her old scrapbooks. She was concerned with the here and now in the larger world. But at the same time, meritorious as that later career was, she didn't become news on the front page when she died in earlier this year in February because she was former ambassador to Czechoslovakia and Ghana dies. That's not what the article said. It was that she was the greatest child star in history.
John Kasson, author of The Little Girl Who Fought the Great Depression and a professor of history and American studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being on the program.
It's my pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.